very graceful. Excuse me. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals, both of you. And hope you had an easy time getting here. I wanted to mention that the recordings are being made, of audio recording of the oral arguments, and they should be available on our website this afternoon. If not this afternoon, then tomorrow. Do you think? Okay. And there are no special announcements, so we can go ahead and get started if council are ready. Okay, I'll ask the deputy clerk to call the case. The first case, Williams.
The court will now call Williams versus the state. And may it please the court, Ms. Sarah Rowland to argue for the appellate, and Ms. Laura Thomas to argue for the state.
Okay, Ms. Rowland, would you ready? Are you ready to begin?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I want to start in the reverse order of the briefs in talking about the points. I want to start with the introduction of the video first. And if you read this entire record from start to finish, voir dire to the end, it is crystal clear that the appellant's lawyer's theory of the case throughout trial was that the fabrication existed at the very beginning. The lie that HN told was at the very beginning when she made the outcry. That's the theory from the beginning of the case through the end of the case. And the theory was that that lie or that fabrication was repeated to the different people she came into contact with. If you look at the record, too, it's actually both sides, the state and the defense, who talk about inconsistencies. It's the state first in voir dire when they talk about the wedding analogy. And they bring out the wedding analogy to talk about inconsistencies. The defense kind of counter analogy to that is the hair analogy. But what the appellant did in this case was expose the initial lie and point out that it was initially a fabrication by exploring that a lie doesn't hold up if you have to continue to tell it. There can be inconsistencies in it. That was the analogy with the hair. And the state even acknowledges that in their brief that appellant's counsel put forth indeed the best trial strategy available, and that was to expose the inconsistencies from the very beginning in HN's testimony and statements, and that's at page 20 in their brief. And the case law is crystal clear on this, starting with Tome, going to Hammonds, even last year with Bosquez from this Court of Appeals in talking about prior consistent statements, and that's they cannot be admitted to counter all forms of impeachment or to bolster the witnesses merely because they've been discredited or their credibility has been attacked. You cannot do that. If that were to be the rule, then you could introduce prior consistent statements at any point in time as substantive evidence. And then the whole motive or the whole focus of the trial shifts from what's happening in court to what's happened out of court in statements. And that's the United States Supreme Court in Tome. What Hammonds specifically says, as this court well knows, is that the rule of prior consistent statements cannot be construed to permit the admission of what would otherwise be hearsay anytime a witness's credibility or memory is challenged. That's exactly what happened here. Were that true, cross-examination would always turn the prior consistent statement into non-hearsay. That can't happen. If you look at the specific facts of Hammonds, it becomes crystal clear that that's exactly what the lawyer is insinuating. The lawyer's not just insinuating, flat out saying that there's fabrication, that you're making up testimony. My lawyer gave me these dates. He's manufacturing evidence. Those were the quotes from Hammonds. And that's why it was clear in that case that, sure, you can get into prior consistent statements there. There's nothing in the record of this case that even comes close to that suggestion at all. it was crystal clear in Hammonds that there was some sort of conspiracy, and they actually used that word, conspired, to create these dates because there was the civil lawsuit going on, too, that they had lost. You can read the state's brief, and it's clear that they agree that the questions here were benign, and just questioning a witness's credibility does not raise to the level of prior consistent statements. The state's argument seems to be that what happened here was when appellate's counsel asked anything about the meeting with the state or questioned her inconsistency too much, that automatically means then you get a prior inconsistent statement. And if you look at the record, that doesn't quite bear out. You know, the state initially brought up HN meeting with them in their direct, if you look at that. And that's volume 3, page 52. They initially bring that up. Then the defense lawyer asks three questions on cross-examination. Those questions are, how many times have you met with the DA's office? Was it within the last month? And then outside the last month, have you met with them within the year? That was it. There's a outside the presence of the jury discussion between the state, the defense lawyer, and the judge, and that whole discussion focuses on, at that point in time, not mentioning or alluding to the fact that there was a prior mistrial or a prior trial of any sort. That is clearly the focus, if you look at the record, of that exchange there. When they pick back up in front of the jury, there's no more questions at that point in time about any kind of meetings with the DA's office, any sort of attempt to allude to coaching, colluding, anything like that. It was simply, as the appellant's lawyer said, outside the presence of the jury, I'm trying to figure out who all she's talked to, how many times she said this initial lie. The state's redirect then, after that, they ask the one question, and that's, we've met with you a few times, and we've only ever told you to do what? Tell the truth. And then in the end, in the defense case in chief, the defense does recall HN. They don't ask, how many times have you met with the state? They don't ask anything like that. Two potential questions that the state could be focusing on here for their argument are, focusing on inconsistencies. Do you remember telling the DA's office that you screamed for 2 to 3 seconds? And that's at volume 5, page 87 and 88. And then, do you remember telling the DA's office that you were surprised that no one woke up to the screaming in the house? That's it. That's literally it. A defense lawyer has to be free to attack inconsistencies. You just have to be. There's no charge here of improper motive, fabrication, anything like that. And if you look at, if you look at Bosquez, that's the case that both sides cite in their brief, which is a little bit interesting, because if you look at that, that's out of this Court of Appeals from last year, 2014. And if you look at that, it's a little bit of the inverse, because the defense was trying to prove up a prior consistent statement there, and the court, this Court of Appeals said, you don't get there. You don't get there. The totality of the state's questions on cross-examination regarding the June drug case, all they did was attack the general credibility and didn't suggest that there was any kind of recent fabrication. All the case law that talks about prior consistent statements and fabrication talks about the fabrication. The fabrication in this case was at the inception, when she initially reported it when she was in trouble for running away. That's the motive. That was the defense lawyer's motive this whole time. And then to discuss any kind of harm as a result of this, you apply obviously the standard under 44.2b, and you have to look at the whole thing. The state did a good job of making a chart and talking about the different words or testimony that was said in the video versus what was said at trial. But if you look at the record, that wasn't the focus, and that's not where the harm lies here. And to be clear, the state, if you look at the closing argument, okay, the state's closing argument in this trial, the state specifically pointed out and emphasized the CAC video during closing on at least 4 separate occasions. right at the very beginning. And this is what they said, on Tuesday and today you met a poised, articulate 15-year-old. But make no mistake that today is about that scared 12-year-old little girl in that room. That room being the CAC video room. A little girl who in that video, this is the next sentence, a little girl who in that video could barely say the word penis. Volume 5, page 93. Following that, HN was so consistent in all of her statements. Recall HN in that video. This is not some story she concocted 9 months later to get her out of trouble. That's the focus of the state in their closing argument. If you look at the defense's closing argument, they talk about inconsistencies. And that's it. They don't talk about allude to or attempt to talk about any coaching, collusion, anything like that. The statement's inconsistencies are there, and to go back to the hair analogy, it's basically how many inconsistencies are you going to allow when you judge someone's credibility and whether or not they're telling the truth. The jury then, and I know you do in the record, you know what happens after that. The jury specifically asks for the CAC video. Okay, they're specifically looking for that. And the reason they're looking for that, they say, the foreman says, we wanted to watch some behavior and some other things on the video. Several people wanted to look at her demeanor. They wanted to see how she behaved in it. That's what they're looking for. That's absolutely what they're looking for. And that's what you see in the video. When you watch it, you see, you hear not just the words, you see her demeanor, you see the pauses, you see the hand gestures, you hear the stuttering, you hear the soft-spokenness, you see the mood and affect. That's what's absent from the black and white of what's in the trial transcript. That's what's missing from the testimony. That's why there can be no fair assurance that the admission of the CAC video did not have any kind of influence or injurious effect in this particular case. To further talk about, that seems like all the interesting stuff in this trial happened at the end, I guess. The other points of errors obviously center on the exhibit that should not have gone back to the jury room. I think everybody will concede that that exhibit should not have gone back to the jury room. There's no argument to the contrary. And what went back is the interview of Mr. Williams. And I don't know if this court has seen what that looks like, but the exhibits, when they went back in disc form, were clear like that. That's how they went back, and so that's how you can read what's on the actual disc as well as see what's on the outside. 31A looks like this. You can read absolutely what's on the outside of the disc. What you see in big red at the bottom, too, and is unmissable, is 31A mistrial record. Totally clear from the entirety of this record from the very inception that the reference to evidence of anything about a mistrial or previous trial regarding this particular defendant is something that the trial court, the state, and the defendant all wanted to avoid. They'd had a mistrial less than a month earlier. They didn't want to have to do it again. I get that. I understand that. And so they were very careful from the inception not to do or say anything to suggest that there had been that previous trial. In this case, the record of it bears out very differently than any of the other cases actually cited by either side in the brief, specifically unlike the Johnson case that the state points out, because in this case it is clear, and the trial court says it on the record, that this, the fact that there's a mistrial, would be very prejudicial. The exact quote is the court, yeah, I think it would be very prejudicial for them, the jury, to have any belief that this case had been tried at some other time and the court grants its own motion in limine to that effect. So here, unlike the Johnson case, unlike other cases, we have the trial court acknowledging and saying it's going to be prejudicial and harmful. Briefly, as to the state's contention that the appellant did not preserve error with regard to the charge, this court knows that that's not necessary when you ask for a mistrial. When a request for an instruction to disregard is essential to the preservation of error only when such an instruction could have had the effect desired by the requesting party. That's Court of Criminal Appeals, Cruz versus State, 225 Southwest 3rd, 546. It would have, the appellant's contention is, would have helped and may have made this error here harmless, but the fact that the judge didn't give such an instruction actually only further compounded the effect that you have some evidence that shouldn't have gone back that did. The question in this kind of analysis, if there's no fact issue about whether the jury received, got that evidence, and the evidence was adverse, then reversal is required. Bustamante stands for the position that the jury got evidence there, but everybody was individually polled and asked and instructed not to consider that evidence. The fact that that didn't happen here is significantly different and harmful to appellant. And in addition, the difference here versus the other cases is appellant raised a due process concern.
I have a question.
Sure.
Before you sit down.
Yes, ma'am.
With regard to that instruction, wasn't there a general instruction in the charge for the jury not to consider anything that wasn't evidence introduced at the trial?
There was a general instruction in the charge. The appellant's contention is the difference here is that after the court discovered that that evidence was erroneously introduced, there wasn't the additional instruction like in Bustamante, like in the other cases. But yes, there was, to answer your question directly.
Okay, and I have another one.
Sure.
And then we'll see if other judges have
any. Yes, ma'am.
What exactly would have been the prejudice or the harm to the defendant of the jury knowing that there had been a mistrial?
I think you can almost equate it to the other cases that are cited in the brief that deal with the mugshots or a prior criminal record. If you know that there's been a trial before with this same defendant, this jury doesn't necessarily know it was this same trial that ended in a mistrial. The problem is there's been a trial with this defendant before, a criminal case that's ended in a mistrial, and I think that that's probably why the judge said what she did at the very beginning.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Either of you have any questions? Okay, thank
what
you.
I do.
Oh, yes, sir.
What you showed us a disc. And you said this has got on here mistrial. And
yes, sir.
Does it say mistrial or does it say mistrail?
It says mistrial, and I can hand it to you if you want. I came into this appeal late. I actually took it over from Dawn Boswell when she came to work at Tarrant County, and I thought the record indicated that a picture was provided to the Court of Appeals, but I couldn't ever find it, so I just went to the clerk and printed off my own. I'm happy to show it closer to you if you would like.
I don't think we better look at that until it's properly admitted in the record.
Yes, sir, I understand.
Thank you, though.
Yes, sir.
Has the record been supplemented with it?
It indicated that it had, yes, ma'am.
All right, thank you very much. Ms. Tomlin.
May it please the court. This court should affirm the trial court's denial of the motion for mistrial and find no error in a lack of a jury instruction or the admittance of the forensic interview as a prior consistent statement. First, the mistrial, which we just discussed and had questions on. The disc, the 31A, and it should be supplemented with the record because that's how I saw it, was on the record. The actual disc had the defendant's name, had a delta sign defendant's name, and it's the sleeve that had the court reporter's sticker that said mistrial record. When the court brought in the three jurors to question them about whether they saw that, only one of the jurors said they saw it. And the court specifically asked her, how did you pick out this disc? And she said it was a process of elimination. When she would see the defendant's name, she kind of put it aside because she knew they were looking for the forensic interview. So when she saw HN's name, she grabbed that disc. And an important thing about the jury charge, was that it stated that if any evidence has been withdrawn from the jury by the court, you will not discuss or consider it for any purposes. So here, once the court found that the court did not think that the jury had noticed or discussed the mistrial sticker, they took away the disc, and according to that instruction, the jury was instructed not to consider it, and without evidence to the contrary, we're to presume that the jury followed those instructions. As far as the whether it was prejudicial, the mistrial sticker, appellant in their brief and today is broadly stating, yes, it was prejudicial because they had a prior trial, but there aren't specific facts. And Johnson v. State from 1999 out of the San Antonio court, it's not a published case, but it's almost the exact same situation. An envelope was sent back to the jury room, and it had mistrial / hung jury written on it. The court there said that with an absence of specific facts in the record showing that that notation of mistrial / hung jury was detrimental or adverse, they couldn't find that without specific facts showing it, they couldn't find it detrimental or adverse. And there they found that it likely operated in appellant's favor because it's telling the jury that this has gone to trial and the prosecution did not prove it before. Really, a juror that's a lay person might not know anything about what this mistrial said, on top of there being evidence here that they never noticed or discussed this sticker. Appellant cites Carroll v. State, a 1999 case out of Austin, the mugshot case where a mugshot was sent back. I think that would be detrimental and adverse because it was a mugshot of a different crime. So it's telling the jury that this person has been arrested for a different crime previously. And that's not what we have here. All it is a statement of mistrial without anything else.
Couldn't the jury believe that where there's smoke, there's fire? And if the court thought that it was, the court might think that it's worthy of retrial by having a mistrial and a retrial. I mean, couldn't they? There's a lot of presumptions the jury could make, but I could see the jury could think, well, there must be something to it if they're going to go after it again. The judge lets them do it again.
Yes, Your Honor. The jury.
I know it's not the judge's call, but jurors don't know that.
Yes, Your Honor. And so the jury could have thought that, but then they could have thought what the state argues, that the prosecution couldn't prove it before. I mean, really, it is a lot of presumption, and there's no telling. But there's nothing specific. There's no specific fact saying that it is prejudicial. Right now, we're just totally speculating either way because there's no facts for or against its prejudice.
And what's the standard the court has to apply to decide whether there was harm in that situation?
Well, I couldn't find a case specifically saying it is a constitutional or non-constitutional harm analysis, but the Woodall case out of this court in 2002 and the Carroll case that I mentioned out of Austin in 1999, they both stated that assuming the constitutional error standard applies. So while it hasn't been decided, I guess, explicitly, I guess we assume that the constitutional error applies. And here I think that the jury already had some idea that there was a mistrial. First, the properly exhibit 31, which was the interview with the defendant that was not 31A that said mistrial, had redacted written on the front of it. And the juror who read the disc said she did read the information on the actual disc, which included this redacted. More importantly, appellant's counsel asked both mother and HN about their previous testimony several times. And like Justice Sutterth mentioned, that could mean that they could think that, I mean, we're speculating here, but it could mean that they would speculate there would be a mistrial just based on there has been previous testimony. So the state's position is there was not harm because of the evidence that appellant committed this crime, the appellant was able to put forth his best trial strategy, and the jury already had an idea that there was a prior trial. As far as the jury instruction, any error would be harmless as the trial court found that the trial that the jury did not notice or discuss the mistrial sticker, and the jury charge told them to disregard evidence that was taken away, told them to only consider facts and evidence. And also when they wrote a jury note, they got a response that they were to only consider the facts and evidence. And I think the jury note also shows that they were willing to write a note when they were confused, but they didn't write a note asking, where's 31A, why does 31A say mistrial, or anything like that. Moving to the forensic interview argument, under 801E1B, the 801E1B is a minimal foundation requirement for an implied charge of fabrication, and it requires only a suggestion that a witness consciously altered their testimony. The trial court looks at the tone and tenor, demeanor, and facial expressions of the cross-examiner, which we can't really do from the trial record. And the trial court here found that the appellant's counsel was making an implication of fabrication. And here, when the appellant vigorously questioned HN about her credibility, about the timeline of things, and then immediately followed it up with the questions about the meetings with the DA's office, when the jury left, they were left with the implication that there might have been some sort of fabrication. And I say that because it's in the record, you can clearly see that HN was confused and not sure how to answer these questions because of the motion in limine of the mistrial. So a jury seeing her saying she's not sure when she's met with the DA's office and looking evasive might add to the fact that that there was an implication that at the DA's office she, or after meetings with the DA's office, she she fabricated her testimony or had an improper motive as far as her testimony. In the hearing,
as I was reading the record, it appeared to me that the decision to admit that evidence was made by the trial judge out of the presence of the jury during the time that there was a voir dire or out of the presence questioning of this complainant by defense counsel and some by the state. Is my recollection correct in that the trial judge said, okay, with what you're saying you're here in this out of the presence of the jury discussion, I'm going to decide that the state's going to be allowed to play the whole recording.
Your Honor, I think the judge did allow in the forensic interview after an out of court, like an outside of the presence of the jury hearing, but based on the questioning of the appellant's counsel and appellant's counsel's looking at the whole record as far as opening statement, voir dire, recalling of HN, I think there is enough that he opened the door to this prior consistent statement.
In other words, it's not a matter of what was said off the record, on the record, but out of the presence of the jury, but rather what was asked in the presence of the jury that rendered the court's, that based upon which, that's what the court based its decision on to allow that evidence.
Yes, Your Honor. I guess I can't get in the mind of the trial court, so maybe she had done it wrong, but I think
I'm talking about your position in terms of the opening of the door. Where did it occur? Did it occur during the actual questioning, in presence of the jury, or out of the presence of the jury?
The opening of the door happened when the jury was present, in the initial questioning of HN, where that he asked her about her credibility and then asked few questions about and after he asked those few questions about her meetings with the DA's office outside the presence of the jury, he said to the trial court that the district attorney's office and HN had conversations about what her testimony has changed from that trial to this trial, and that's in the record volume 3 at 82. And so he's telling the trial court at that point outside the presence of the jury that he thinks that her testimony has changed, which shows that that's why he was asking about her meetings with the DA's office. Appellant argues in his brief and at trial that he was just doing a fact-finding mission to find out what HN had looked at to prepare for trial. But And they also argue that the DA and the trial court at the time of that initial outside of the presence hearing did not think he had opened the door. But just because they didn't say they thought that didn't mean they didn't know he opened the door, because obviously they did when the state later brought in the prior consistent statement. And also, whether it was his intention or not, if the door's open, the door's open, and the prior consistent statement can come in. When looking at this, you can look at the totality of the trial to see that, to solidify that there was an implication of fabrication. And first and foremost, the recall of HN. There's seven questions in volume 5, 87 through 89, where appellant's counsel asked HN about her meetings with the DA's office. I think there's only a few questions in that whole recall that aren't specifically asking about the DA's office and what she told the DA's office, showing where appellant's counsel was going. Also, the hair analogy that started in voir dire and he finished up in closing argument, he talks about the DA's office putting hairs in the story. And reading the record, hairs seem to be lies in the story. So saying that, he's saying that the DA's brought hairs in the stories. He's asked several questions on two different times about HN's meetings with the DA's office, and it shows that he's implicating that through the DA's, that she was improperly, there was improper motive after she met with the DA's office. As far as the motive to fabricate, the trial court found that there doesn't have to be just one motive to fabricate. I think it's obvious that the appellant's counsel thought there was a motive to fabricate when she outcried based on having an older boyfriend. But then I think there can also be another motive to fabricate before trial to make her story sound better. And as my time's running out, I'll talk about harmless. The state made an 8-page chart on all the things in the forensic interview that were all covered in properly admitted testimony. And since it's well established that improper admission of evidence is not reversible error if it's been introduced properly through other admitted evidence, there should not be harm here. So appellant's trial was without reversible error, and the state prays that his conviction be affirmed. If there's no more questions, I can sit. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Rebuttal?
Okay. To start with the mistrial, I guess, again, it's clear from the questioning of the jurors that they looked at the face of the discs, and when you see the supplemental record, you cannot miss where it says mistrial. It's by Mr. Williams' name, and it's in red. It's the only thing in red. The jury instruction, there's a general jury charge that includes the general instruction that Justice Gardner referenced, but then the problem here is, unlike Bustamante, unlike the other cases, there's no follow-up curative instruction here, jury instruction, after everyone's realized that 31A has inadvertently gone back to the jury room. You know, and we don't know, and you cannot tell, based on the face of that disc, the mistrial disc, if this is from the same case or a different case or what it is. It's just Andrew Williams, the same guy's name again. And we don't know, based on looking at this, why a mistrial was granted at all. What we do know, the state's saying that there's no evidence at all that anything was about the mistrial was prejudicial, and I think that that's not true based on the record in this case, where you have the trial court and the state and the defense lawyer, but specifically the trial court, making the comment at the very beginning when everybody's trying to avoid the big elephant in the room, saying, yeah, I think it would be very prejudicial for them to have any belief that this case had been tried at some other time. And the court on its own grants the motion in limine to that effect. So that is distinguishable and different in this record, separate and apart from the Johnson case that the state cited and any other case having to do with mistrials or hung juries. You know, this trial sticker just said mistrial. It didn't say hung jury. There's a difference there, I think. And we don't know what the jurors believed or thought. As far as the CAC video goes, here's the big deal difference. you watch the video that occurred 3 years before the trial testimony, you have a 15-year-old testifying at trial. 15-year-old looks, acts, and sounds much different than when you have a child who's 12 years old on a videotape. It goes back to what the jurors expressed, their concerns being, we want to see how she's acting. We want to see the demeanor. We want to see the reactions. Those are not verbal things that can be spoken or were spoken in any kind of trial testimony through any of the witnesses. That's what these jurors, according to the foreman, were focused on. And if you look at the sequence of events, we know that it was harmful because when they finally did get the CAC video, which is about an hour and 3 minutes long, they get the video, and then almost to the minute, an hour later, we've got a verdict, and it's a guilty verdict. So you have to assume, and it's a reasonable assumption to make, that that verdict was based in large part, if not in total, on what was on that video, what they saw, how they saw her acting, behaving, the way she was talking. That's much different when you're talking about a 12-year-old versus a 15-year-old at trial. Everything else, I think, is sufficiently covered within the brief, unless there's other questions. I know I've got seconds remaining. Thank you.
Ms. Meyer.
Thank you. Appreciate your arguments, and both briefs are excellent. We really appreciate those, too. Thank you for your hard work. It will make our job easier. And let's see, this is the only oral argument. We're not having the other ones. Okay. We will consider those and submit them in conference. Your case is submitted. Thank you very much. And you're excused. And we'll stand in recess.
All right.